Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Command Zone. This is episode numero 33. I'm your host, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
And I'm Craig Blanchett.
I just totally ran over your words. I'm so sorry, Craig.
Dude, you are like a pro now.
Yeah, I was going to do the like, I'm Andrew Lozer's love. But
he's like, guys, I've been on the show 15,000 times. I will just introduce my damn self.
Yep, and Craig, you did it. So that's Craig Blanchett, everybody, joining us on the show today.
Co-producer, co-creator of Top Decking, the web series. Yeah. I don't think we plugged that enough last time.
I agree. We need to plug this show more.
Yeah, if you play Magic, then you will like a web series about Magic the Gathering. So
absolutely.
Definitely check it out. You can find it. Where can we find it, Craig?
On YouTube.
We should mention that we're teaming up with our sister podcast, The Masters of Modern, and Craig and the people behind Top Decking, the web series, and sort of creating a new, I don't know, channel on YouTube. And we've got some other content in the works. There'll be more announcements about that soon. Keep your ears out.
So today's episode, again, is a question-based episode. We had so many great answers to this last week, and also we're giving away prizes to everyone.
I don't know if our answers were great, but the questions were good.
The questions were good, yeah. We'll take a back seat on whether or not tooting our own horn here. But all of these lucky people asked us questions on Twitter or over email, and we're going to answer them. And if you get your question answered on air, you get a prize. You're a winner, winner.
Winner, winner. Now, if you want to actually receive your prize, then when you hear your name on air, you're going to have to email us at commandcast@rocketjump.com and give us your mailing address so that we can send you the cool stuff.
That's right. So congrats to you guys all in advance. And I think it's time to ring the customary bell because you've won prizes.
Bing!
Woo!
That's all our bell.
Right. That's just the bell.
Bing!
I gotta say, I did see this stuff too, and this stuff is awesome. I am jealous of everybody receiving stuff for bringing in their questions.
As we mentioned last week, Josh has brought a Modern Masters pack into the mix. I've got an Innistrad booster pack in the mix, and we also have lots of cool, just random foils, random rares, and
playmats,
other booster
really,
packs. Yeah,
really cool
Funko
stuff.
Pop figures. We still have a Commander 2014 green deck, although that may have gone out with the first batch. Who knows? Who knows?
You'll know when you get it in the mail.
That's right.
Be sure
right.
when you get it to tweet out your or Instagram out your picture to us.
Whoever gets the Modern Masters pack, please show us the foil Goyf.
Yes, yes, please do. Let us know.
And the regular Goyf in the regular Mythic spot.
They're going to get Goyf and a foil Goyf.
Of course.
I'm going to say this.
It happens like one out of every three packs.
Yeah.
Gosh.
That is
that's what
statistically
happens with
true.
That's why I love statistics, guys. I will say, though, and this is weird because it is truly random, but the pack that I've sent out, I've had some pictures come back with some awesome pulls, some foil rares. We've got like
foil Rabble Master.
Yeah, it was pretty. The Rabble Master I don't think was foil, but the card is still like over $10, so it's an awesome pull. All right, so let's get on to the questions for today. And starting it off, and of course, we're going to have the lovely Abby Drake reading all of the questions as well. Bring a new dramatic flair to the podcast that was not prior there. Actually, maybe it was prior there. Who knows?
No. Abby definitely brought it with her. It wasn't here before.
That's right. And she's also introing. She's the person that's behind the intro and the finale of both this show and the Masters of Modern. So the first question is from John Belknap over email. And the question is,
how do I learn to expect when someone has an answer to my strategy and not get demolished when I go for the kill?
So this is called reading your opponent.
Yes.
It's more of an art than a science.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple things to look for. One is just open mana.
Definitely.
Yeah, one is just open mana. The other is what color of that mana. And as you play more, you'll learn what colors are sort of to watch out for specific types of things that you're doing. So if white is open, you may have to worry about board wipes. If blue's open, obviously counter spells. If, I don't know, red's open, then you have to worry about things that are damage-based.
Yeah.
More than just destruction-based.
There's some destruction-based things.
But
that
not
like
that many.
Yeah,
if it's
exactly.
green that's open, you don't have to worry as much. But maybe like enchantment removal could be green.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of times if you see certain colors open, you know what you don't have to worry about. So So if you see only black mana available, you don't have to worry about getting countered.
And the nice thing is that you're at a table with multiple players. Usually you're going to attack the person that you think has the least chance of demolishing you when you're going for the kill or whatever. Or just learn to not go for the kill and learn how to play around certain stuff. Especially if you're playing with people you play with before, you know what's in their deck.
I mean, if you're going for something like you've got Purphoros on the table and you can cast Prosh and basically kill everybody, you just need to look for that window where it looks safe. And a lot of times that's going to mean not doing it at the first opportunity.
Right.
It's going to mean casting it at the time when these two players are tapped out and this other guy only has green mana available.
Or you can tap out, or you won't tap out when you cast it, so you have another spell that is a little insurance on top of that.
Right. You might draw out a counterspell. You know, I do that a lot. It's like, well, I know that deck's a counter deck, or it has quite a few counters, so I'll wait until I have two pretty good threats and I can actually play them both in one turn.
Yeah.
And then I'll play one of them and hope he counters that, and then I'll play the second one, and it's like, well, at least I get something out.
Yeah.
That's another way to go. The other thing to pay attention to is just people's eyes. And in Commander, it's very, very obvious because the board state's so complicated that you have to, it's really hard to be sly about what you're looking at. And the way that people are usually situated, like you have to turn your head fully to the left to see what that guy's got on his board and fully to the right to see what that guy's got on his. And you can sort of see who people are eyeing. And if you pay attention to that, you can sort of tell like, well, this guy's worried about me, but that guy over there is not worried about me. So then that will sort of inform when you can act based on who is sort of being hyper-vigilant about you and who's not.
If you've ever played poker before, Commander's a lot like poker where you're playing the people, not so much, you know, you're playing their decks as well. But, you know, I would say like a literal way to answer this question is look at their lands first. If their lands are tapped out, that, you know, what's their left? You know, Force of Will or Pact of Negation or some variant of that. And then look at their board. If they have an answer on the board, then obviously don't do anything. But other than that, you know, then read their face. And if they look like they're boned, then go for the kill.
Yeah.
I think there are also times, you know, just keep this in mind. There are times where you just don't have any choice. So, like, you got seven poison counters and the guy's going to do something and kill you next turn for sure. And it's like, yeah, my thing may get countered or it may get destroyed or whatever. But if my only chance is if that doesn't happen, then do it.
Right.
Definitely. So good question, John. All right, moving on. We got a question from Kristen Koch at Dune Echo on Twitter. And the question is, what?
No, I just had, there was a guy at my high school and he spelled his last name K-O-C-H, but it was actually pronounced Cook. So I'm not saying.
Oh, you know what? I think it actually is Coke or a Cook.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Sorry, Kristen. So the question is.
Just curious, but what are the most unique commander decks you've encountered?
Chromat? Josh's Five Color Chromat is definitely unique.
It is very unique.
Eli, I'll shout out Eli, our editor. Oh, yeah. He has a Dwarven deck. It's actually a Barbarians deck because they have retconned all the Dwarves to Barbarians. But it is an all-Dwarf deck.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like Dwarves.
I haven't actually seen it, but when we had Brian David Marshall on our podcast, he talked about a guy who had an all-white bordered deck, which I think is awesome, and I want to build one really bad.
And it offends some people to no end, which is great, too.
I'm so mad about me.
That offends me.
Are you
greatly.
One of those?
You're
a bigot? Truther.
I've actually made a few of my decks all black bordered, and to go all
you are one of those.
I get it. Monster, but Greg. It's...
You're one of those. How can you... You cannot keep the white border down, man.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, are there enough good ones to make it work?
This oppression will not stand.
I want to make it very clear that I am talking specifically about Magic right now.
No. Hey, listen, white-bordered cards are still cards.
Yes.
Right. They are people. No, they're not people. They're just cards. They're just little pieces of cardboard. That is definitely unique. I think I've seen some... the Ashling deck I played is unique because, it's a variation on...
Phil from the Five Commanders podcast played
like
a deck
95 lands and some
99 things. Lands and an Ashling.
Yeah, or in Phil's case, there's a few alterations in there. But, that is a unique deck to play because it's a very interesting board threat to keep in mind that you're also just kind of not worried about, and that's when you can get into trouble. Greg?
Trying to think of unique decks I've faced.
I guess your Infect is pretty unique in our group.
No, he's got nine of them. How can
he
be unique?
Only one. He's the only one that plays it. So.
But I mean, it's not. He has nine. I've seen nine different ones. I mean, I like to think my Tim deck is pretty unique.
I haven't seen one of those. The Tapper. Yeah. Deck. I like that deck a lot.
I think your build of the Chromat deck is very unique. I think D's build of Sigarda is very unique.
I like that decks are also unique to the players that build them.
Yeah.
It really is like a Freudian thing. Like your deck is built the way that you. It's like a deep search into your soul, what cards you put in there.
I mean, no matter what you do, you can't escape like who you are at the root of it, and your deck will always show that.
Whenever somebody has something that's like, this deck is all dwarves or this deck is all, you know, soldiers or something like that, I have a, you know, a respect for that.
Because
it's like, okay, you appreciate the lore of the game. You know, you're a Melvin or whatever.
A Vorthos.
All right, on to our next question, or listener question. It's from Bruce. Actually, Bruce has a couple. He's at Brawlmac. Is that how you say it? Yeah, I was going to say Brawlmanac.
I think Brawlmanac is kind of cool, too. Brawlmac sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings.
At Brawlmac. All right, take it away, Abby.
If you could only make a deck from one set or block, not counting commander sets, what would you choose and why?
Wow. Okay, well, mine would be Time Spiral block.
Time Spiral? I don't even know the cards in Time Spiral.
Well, Time Spiral, Planar Chaos, Future Sight, they just have the most mechanics. It's the most complicated set ever made. I think I heard once Mark Rosewater said that, like, before that block, the entirety of Magic had like 50 mechanics.
Oh,
and that block alone has like 48 mechanics.
Oh my gosh. That's insane.
Some of them were reused mechanics from because it was a nostalgia set, but I just think it has the most complexity. And the other set I would say is Khons, and that's simply because Khons is the only block with that amount of lands.
Yeah, and also a lot of legendary creatures that are very tight. Like, it would be a very interesting game if you just had Khons.
Yeah, that's true, actually. You have to have enough legendary creatures.
It's really about the wedges, you know?
I would definitely go Mirrodin Besieged.
Yeah, because it's got this card that
actually, for a different reason.
What?
Somewhat.
Sure, Craig.
Yeah, sure.
The Praetors. The Praetors are some of my favorite EDH cards ever.
Like Elesh Norn.
Elesh Norn.
I think the Praetors are all going to get, I mean, there's been a lot of talk that those are going to get reprinted.
I hope so. I hope so, and I don't, because I have enough of them that, like, I'm monetarily invested. But then again, I love those cards. I mean, love to see more people.
Don't you want
to
draft them?
I would love to see them in the hands of more people. So go ahead.
Don't you want to draft them?
I would love to.
Imagine a draft deck with Elesh Norn.
In, like, multiplayer? Oh, multiplayer draft.
Yeah, it's true.
We'll have to do some conspiracy Modern Masters 2 mashup drafts. That'll be fun.
I'm really looking forward to what Dragons of Tarkir is going to do this block. Also, because this is the final block of these three sets. I would also maybe say the Worldwake block, but just because it would be really crazy.
You mean the Zendikar block?
Zendikar block, right? Yeah. If you just got those giant Eldrazi. I mean, it would just be Eldrazi dominated. But I'm thinking, like, wow, this would be really cool because you could, like, box it in a thing that's just like Rise of the Eldrazi, Magic the Gathering. Like, this is what it's about.
Eldrazi is my favorite draft set ever. I couldn't argue with you about it.
It'll be
just
pretty
playing
crazy.
With those cards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next question from Bruce.
What are your favorite spells to cast in each color?
not just red, Jimmy. Jimmy, I like how he knows you. You were only going to say red spells, but now you can't. Ha ha. I don't know if I can go through every color.
Yeah. I'll just say some favorite spells to cast then.
Yeah, okay.
Cyclonic Rift.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
Hercule's Recall, if I'm going to go
Hercule's
blue.
Recall?
Yeah, that card is...
I didn't see that coming.
When it really works, that card blows the table apart.
Demonic Tutor?
Yep.
What else? I went into black. You guys
can't just say red.
Shieldred.
You know, I will say Insurrection. That's my one red card that I'm going to say. It's the big daddy of the red cards, yeah.
Like the Praetors, any one of them... The blue one, if you have 10 mana, is just bonkers. White one, everybody else's creatures get -2/-2.
Yeah.
Wheel of Fortune.
Yep.
Okay.
Because it has this simultaneous feeling of, like, I draw a bunch of cards, but also everybody else at the table goes,
because certainly love
I just ruined everybody's plans at the same time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially on the build up, like before you have mana, you know, you're like, yes, you know, in three turns I'm going to be able to cast this, and like before that I'm going to cast this. And then it's Wheel of Fortune.
What?
Josh, you're not, like, you're kidding, right? Dude, you don't want to do that.
Like, dude, Darth Vader is your father. I'm sorry, man.
What is Wheel of Fortune cast to play? One red and how many others?
That is certainly
two color, two and a red. So you can do it on turn three. The best thing is if you do it on turn three, sometimes you just mana screw people.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can just draw the 7-card hand with no mana in it, and you've only dropped 2 lands, maybe, and it's just like, you could just randomly, which is not the goal of it. I usually don't play it on turn 3, but I like to play it on, like, turn 5 or 6, right when everybody's about to cast their, like, powerful stuff.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say Blood Moon then. It's one of my favorite cards.
Oh,
to cast.
Man.
Yep.
It's the worst.
You took it there. We're going. I just stayed with red.
You don't hate Wheel of Fortune like I hate Blood Moon.
It's true. I actually don't mind Wheel of Fortune at all.
Yeah. You're always the person that's able to like, okay, this is cool. Let's see what I get.
Yeah, everyone else is like, no, the best laid plans. Ah, I've gone to waste.
And honestly, let's not forget, what's your favorite thing to cast when you're playing your commander?
Mm-hmm.
Your commander. Because typically
true.
Your deck is based off your commander.
Yeah.
Not me.
Oh, okay. Maybe not. Yeah, true. You're like the only person that's
four,
not true.
Yeah, like half my decks, I just almost never cast a commander. Maybe not half.
Yeah. All right, one last question here from Bruce, and this one's kind of cool.
Brainstorm a deck where the commander is replaced by a non-mana artifact, but you can play any colors you want.
So we're using an artifact that's not a creature.
It could be a creature. It just can't be. It can't
I
be like Sol
Ring. I think
it
needs to be a not creature, non-mana.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. Okay. So
I think there are options for both. But
what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of like an artifact that's not a creature and not a mana rock?
Scroll Rack.
That's pretty good because card selection. Yeah,
it's a very linear kind of thing. You could
your deck
you
could be anything.
Yeah,
that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's not that.
I was thinking the indestructible one.
Darksteel Plate?
No, the indestructible. All artifacts are indestructible.
Oh, Darksteel Forge.
What about Akroma's Memorial?
Ooh, interesting. You
That's
can
pretty
do a
good.
Token
Give
theme?
Your creatures like every ability ever. That's a pretty good one. I went to like Ankh of Mishra. Which is like all lands do 2 damage to you when you put them into play.
Right, right.
Or Black Vice might be a good one.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Could you imagine?
You turn one Black Vice.
I'm
going to
build
like,
a Jester's Cap deck. That's what I'm going to do. That's an artifact, right? Oh, man. That's a really fun little question, though. I don't know, man.
Ankh of Mishra with a bunch of land destruction would be just like everyone would hate you forever. But
what if you could make
funny.
A land your commander? What land would you make?
Oh, man.
I would do Vesuva. Just give me whatever you want.
Yeah, as long as it's in the battlefield.
Yeah. That's true. You just never go. You can opt not to go first.
Well,
you
do like
roll.
Ink Moth Nexus or Mute Evolved or something like that too. Strip Mine?
Strip Mine, yeah.
I mean, Library of Alexandria. Call. It's banned, right?
Oh,
but
yeah. Yep, there you go. Tolarian. That's banned too. Darn.
Darn.
All right, well, thanks for the questions, Bruce. Next up, we got some questions from Triumph. Is that your real name? Because that's pretty cool. You're at Historian327, which is crazy because my lucky number combination is 328. Well, not from that. But it's because it's March 28th. It's my birthday.
My birthday. It'd be weird if it was just March 28th for a different reason than
just,
that.
Yeah, like I just love March, and 28 was like an appealing number at the time. So there you go. All right, take it away, Abby.
When you have a big old list of cards that could go in a deck, what are some tips for narrowing it down?
Oof. Well,
this could be a whole podcast.
Yeah.
I think
playtesting is really important. Just, you know, literally
but
play
But you have
with
to narrow
card.
It down to test it.
So True. Print them out. There are places that you can go online and print out, you know, the cards. Or just rip up pieces of paper, put them in there, and write down the card that it is. And as long as you know what the card does... Like,
wait,
you know,
I don't
like
think
these
this
guys
is,
are saying playtest.
Yeah, I don't think this is as far as deciding which ones to buy.
Right. Well, I mean, it could be just like if you want to playtest it and you
I
have
just
a list
think he
online
means, like,
somewhere.
I want to include all these cards in my deck. How do I determine which ones actually go in there and which ones?
I always just stare at, I stare at them and then try and like put down a list of which one, how many creatures, how many enchantments, you know, where's my graveyard recursion? What does each card do?
Yeah, I think that's really smart.
Yeah.
What I do is I usually say, well, what's the deck trying to do? So let's say it's Caridor. And I need a certain amount of cards that are going to put things into the graveyard or a certain amount of things that are going to get things out of the graveyard or whatever. Like, you know, if it's Nekusar, I need a certain amount of card draw and I need a certain amount of, you know, cards that do damage to you when everybody or do damage to everybody when they draw those cards. And then I just want to have all those columns and I want to see like how many of each of those columns I have. Like the stop hitting yourself deck I just built. Like, well, I need a certain amount of creatures that do stuff if they get hit. Then I need a certain amount of stuff that hits those creatures.
Right.
And then I need... Every deck needs mana ramp and card draw. I usually like to have at least 10 in each of those categories.
Yeah.
So then you start going, okay, well, really, when you get down to it, I've only got 10 or 12 cards that I really can play with. And then it's like, okay, do I want Swords to Plowshares or do I want Mortify?
Right.
And you just start making those choices.
Also, laying it out and seeing where the mana costs are could be helpful.
Yeah.
And also seeing if there's redundancy when you don't necessarily need it. So if you have all these cards that, like, Token Generation is really easy just to go overboard on. So you just put all the token generators in there, but you don't actually need all of them. You know, choose the ones that work the best and have either the most modal uses, like Lingering Souls, I think, is like an auto include just because it has flashback. You know, that's way better than just creating 2 1-1s for one instant, you know. Like, so make sure that you're optimizing where you can, and don't be afraid to cut cards either. And don't be afraid to think about those cut cards when you're playing with your final list and asking yourself, should I have cut that? Maybe I should try it. And, you know, go back to it. But don't be afraid to cut cards. Otherwise, you're just going to be looking at this list forever. Like, be liberal in your cuts, especially if you're trying to get it down to 100 just to make a playable deck. And then from there, you can ask yourself the questions about whether or not you wanted one of those other cards that may be removed.
Yeah, I really think the first, like, 7 to 10 times you play the deck, your brain should mostly, even more than trying to win the game, be saying, like, okay, how does this feel? What do I wish I had in my hand? What am I have in my hand that feels like it's not doing a lot? And just making mental notes so that you can... And then it's not like you play the deck once and you start making those changes. You play the deck 5 times and you say, well, all 5 of those games, I wished that I had more card draw. Okay, yeah. I need more card draw probably. Or all 5 of those games, I wish that I had more mana. Okay, I need more mana ramp then. Or all 5 of those games, blah, blah, blah. So that's another way and a really smart way to continue to tune it.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Triumph's second question, that's 2 high fives for you, bud, is...
How do you decide when a card is absolutely too weak to be EDH playable versus being specialized but playable in the right deck?
I think a lot of cards fall into the category of it's not playable unless it's playable in the right deck for Commander specifically, because there's so many cards that are just based off your general, like Land Sacking, for instance, would not be very viable in that many decks unless you're playing Titania.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's much more useful in one deck than the other. This is, it feels like this always changes. It's definitely dependent on the card, and you just need to think about it in the world of the deck. And if it's just like a fringe card that needs another card to go off in the deck, and you have 99 singleton cards, like, then it may not be playable at all. But if it's playable with your general and you know that you can get use out of it, but it's just kind of weak in other decks, then you have a card that is specialized good.
I think you know by comparing it to the other cards you're thinking about putting into the deck. It's like you said about Lingering Souls, right?
Right.
If you compare that to Raise the Alarm.
That's the card I was thinking.
Yeah, then all of a sudden, it's pretty clear. Lingering Souls is just better most of the time, you know, because in Commander, we're not so worried about mana cost. And so the fact that it costs a little bit more mana is mitigated by the fact that you can actually use it twice and cast it out of your graveyard. So, you know, that's what happens is when you start laying them out, like Craig suggested earlier, where you're laying them into like their little columns of like what role they're filling, then you compare each card within the column to the other cards in there and say, oh, okay, well, these 3 just seem better than the other ones. So I want to use only the best ones in each column.
Yeah. And Craig, if it says Infect on it, then it's playable, right?
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Our next question is from Aaron Glock, at a Glock. Easy.
It's weird because the seek and the K seem to be out of order, but that's
was that
how it
your,
is.
Was that is that's how it is?
Yeah, no, I double
I'm sure you
it.
Asked your question yourself the same question when you typed it out the first time.
Yeah.
All right, take it away.
How do you build a deck around its color weakness? For example, no counters or board wipes.
This artifacts. Is a very good question. Yeah, artifacts. Artifacts are your solve all for this. In general, it is. Like the big things like card draw or sometimes just straight removal like Spine of Ishsa or whatever.
I think the 3 areas that you're going to be the most need for are board wipes, card draw, and mana ramp. And card draw and mana ramp you need in every single deck, and board wipes you need in almost every single deck. And artifacts cover you pretty well in all those areas. You've got
Nev's Disc,
Perilous Vault,
Oblivion Stone.
Oblivion Stone.
Yeah.
Those are your board wipes from artifacts. You've got Mind's Eye. You've got, you know,
Scroll
Howling
Rack.
Mind, Fount of Mithras, Scroll Rack, Sensei's Divining Top.
You also have
draw.
Consume the Meek, I believe, is colorless. The Eldrazi, or is it? It's one of the Eldrazi spells that's a board wipe.
All is dust.
Yeah, all is dust.
All
I think
is dust.
Colorless. Yeah.
And then you have tons of Worn Power Stone, Thran Dynamo, Gilded Lotus, Soul Ring, Mana Vault, Mana Crypt, like a ton of Mana Rocks, Chromantic Lantern. You know, we can go on forever. And those areas are just necessary in every deck. And then like counter spells. Every deck doesn't need counter spells.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
there are other ways
to counter, quote unquote, their stuff without actually countering it when it gets put on the battlefield.
Yeah, you think of what a counter does, it just negates a card. Hmm. Well, Path to Exile negates a card too. So does Swords to Plowshares.
Right.
Like that's sort of a counter in a way. It's just it's
slightly
narrow
delayed.
That it counters only a creature, and counter spell counters any spell. But you know, those are the ways that you sort of simulate that effect.
And in the big picture of this, too, building a deck around its color weakness, I think you just, in general, don't want to build your deck with a weakness that is easy to exploit that you can't appropriately deal with within your deck as well.
So, well, it's smart to know that the colors have weaknesses mm-hmm. and you need to cover them. So if you're not careful, it's very easy to build a mono red deck that just, mm-hmm. if somebody puts an enchantment out, you can never destroy it. So you need to be aware of it so that you can put the cards in from outside,
yeah.
you know, from the artifacts usually that do those things.
All right. Our next,
recognize this guy too because he.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I think he's won before. You're going to get a second prize from us.
Congrats for asking a great question. MTG Mindslaver at Nicholas Pizer. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Yes, you have asked this question. I believe you have won before. So congrats. And the question is also a fun one. It is.
How do you tell a friend their commander is too OP?
I think you just tell them.
Or
in a way that's reasonable because there are, like, we've talked about this a lot. Like, someone being too OP, it's like at the same time, you're responsible for that person being that overpowered, and there are ways to build your decks so that this isn't an issue. At the same time, if someone is truly dominating, perhaps, like, the game too much with something, then it becomes a matter of etiquette and just sort of having civil discussion between you and the person. And that's like a very broad area. Like, I don't know how I can really instruct you on how to talk.
It's hard
to
because,
else.
You know, without knowing the people and everybody's personality, I mean, you literally the answer is sort of like it depends on the person that you're approaching. But I would say there are some good guidelines. One is it's really going to be tempting to approach somebody right after they've done the OP thing that sort of made you mad. And that's probably not a good time to do it because
when the fire's hot,
it's just not going to look like you're being reasonable. It's going to look like if they just did something when Infinite killed you and you go, your commander's too overpowered.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's hard to take you seriously in that moment because you've just lost to it. So it's a lot better to sort of in a moment where you're not playing Magic before the game or when you just see them someplace else and just be like, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And just be, then it's very hard not to take someone seriously in that instance
right.
where they're coming to you and they're just saying, dude, you know, it might be a little too powerful. It's not super fun to play against. Like,
yeah.
you know, that it's, I will take you way more seriously if you're not saying it directly after I beat you.
True.
Yeah. I would say beforehand is usually the best idea.
Yeah.
If you can see them, you know, putting it out and then you can be like, hey man, I'm like not playing that. I brought, you know, my mid range deck. I don't think it's going to be much of a game.
Or it's like,
I'd
listen,
appreciate
I don't have a deck
it if
that,
you could play something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does somebody like, else have a deck?
And it could be like, that the commander's not OP, or it's just that they're always going infinite. You know, you could say, like, how do you tell someone that blank is blank?
Yeah.
You know, like, this goes across sort of everything. And like Craig said, it's a matter of just being like, hey, I'm trying to test out something. Or, like, hey, like, this guy's playing for the first time. Or, like, hey, so-and-so just doesn't want to play as much, and I really want them to play commander. So, like, is there any other deck that you can bring out? Or is there any way to just, you know, is there something that else that appeals to you as a deck builder or whatever you want to play that could also be fun for you and still offer you the chance to win the way you like to, but also, you know, makes it a little more fun for the people that are getting into the game right now. You know, but again, changes with every situation.
I think the key though is to communicate with the person, be honest about it, do it in the right moment, but don't wait, because what happens is if you say nothing, then the resentment just continues to grow, right? And when you eventually do inevitably sort of confront them about it, then you're going to do it in the worst manner. Like, it's not good to be like, to just yell at somebody all of a sudden. You
to
know?
Pent up, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be much better to just take it at a reasonable time, at a reasonable tone, just, you know, tell them, you know, honestly.
Yeah.
And I would also but not say in a moment of anger. Yeah,
it's not about the player. It's not about the cards. It's about the game. So just don't, you know, don't direct your attention like, you are a bad person.
Yeah, exactly.
You are doing this.
Yeah, exactly. You can, you know, I like to use phrases like, dude, I totally know why you play that. It's super powerful. It looks fun to play, but... you know, it's not that fun to play against. I'm getting a little bored of it. You know, do you think we can try something else?
Yeah.
I like Mindslaver's second question because it is very Vorthos-y to his name. So the question is,
what is your favorite thing to say to get people either confused or on your side?
Ooh. Little,
oh, man,
trickery.
I'm scared to say things because you guys, I play with both of you all the time.
It's true. Reveal your secrets, Josh.
The things I do for this podcast. Notes. Well, I think something that generally works almost every time is, and it works in poker too, although you have to be less obvious about it, is just seeming disappointed with the way things are going at all times. Is just sort of sighing and just being like, every time you
but
draw your card.
Of course.
Yeah, you have to be careful. There's a way, there's like a nice little wheelhouse where you're in, but you guys have seen me do it. all the time, which is just like, you never are like, oh my God, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah.
You just never, ever, ever, literally 100% of the time, never do that. You always are like,
okay. I can't help it. I wear my heart on my sleeve.
Yeah,
Prey
is the
it.
Master of
oh
like...
Oh my God. When I get the card that I'm looking for, my face like lights up.
You can see Craig, and he starts looking at everybody's stuff, and his eyes are like super wide, and his head's like snapping. You know, it's not like slowly glancing at you. He's like, snap to that guy, snap to that guy, snap to that guy. And it's like, uh-oh, somebody's going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Whereas like, I'm the exact opposite. I'm always like shoulders slumped, just looking down. Just like, oh man, how am I going to get out of this one?
And the best is when you get like, from me, I'm like, how's it looking over there? And Josh are like, ah, not good. Because then without even having to like say it yourself, you just told the whole table and everyone kind of, it like, it sits in people's memories.
Yeah, you know? And you just seem like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, oh God, I... You draw your card and you're just like,
I remember you said, like, I was like, oh, mana's not good. And you had played the same number of lands as everyone else.
Yeah.
But it was like five colors. So I was like, I guess it's kind of acceptable that you can say that, even though you have the same number of lands. But like, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I just generally, I mean, I don't even think about it now. It's just an instinct. But it's like, you just generally never at any point seem like you're in command.
Do you do this in poker as well?
In poker, you have to be a lot more careful.
Yeah,
poker is different, and acting strong in poker is oftentimes in your advantage. So in poker, you have to sort of be a lot more cognizant of it, because in EDH, it's almost never to your advantage to act really strong. Every once in a while, it is. You have to bluster a little, but it's much more rare. Whereas in poker, a lot of times the right play is to make your bet in the most confident manner that you can, because you actually want people to fold.
Yeah, you're pushing people out of the pot.
Yeah, you're not even necessarily bluffing. You just, you know, it's just better for you if they fold.
Yeah. Sort of like you had to walk head tilted forward as opposed to backwards when you're playing poker.
Yes.
Good, all well right. Put. Next question comes from Joninho at Joninho11.
How do you feel about stores having EDH FNMs? Do you think it will work? And how would you approach it as a player?
This is an excellent question. Helen Brigeau, of the director of, I guess, I don't know the exact
competitive something or other,
Announced that FNMs are going to open to lots of formats, and Commander,
a whole
EDH,
bunch of them,
is one of those formats. Two-headed giant, all sorts of other fun stuff, and it's great. This encourages the kitchen table aspect of the game. It gets people together to have a good time together, which is good for just things in general, because people are happy, product is being sold, and the game of Magic is getting bigger.
It's tough, though, because EDH, I feel like, is not conducive to what FNM, as we know it, is. You know, FNM, as we know it, is a place where you go, and it's not super competitive, but it has a pretty big competitive aspect. And usually there are prizes. You know, generally at the end of the night, somebody gets some booster packs or whatever.
And it costs money to play as well.
It costs money to play. And this is tough in EDH because... You know, EDH is built around the board game aspect and the multiplayer aspect, and there can be a real, like, a lot of feel bads happen when you get teamed up on.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually encourages it. It encourages collusion. And what collusion is, that's different than an alliance in the game. A collusion is if let's say the three of us went to the store and we said, listen, they're doing 4-player pods. We're just going to team up on the other guy and make sure one of us wins, you know, because there are prizes involved now, and that hurts the integrity of what EDH is. And so I think the way for FNM to work, and this isn't perfect, but it's probably participation based more than you won, because you can't say who won.
No, I think from the papers that I've seen of how these things work, it is largely point based, and it's more... It's not if you kill 5 people fast. It's, you know, you get points for doing certain things. So.
Yeah, point systems are interesting, but they subvert the game too.
Yeah.
Right? Because they change naturally. Like, because the way to play EDH, quote unquote, naturally is to use the political aspect of it.
Right.
But that's in a game where everyone is playing the same game. So there wouldn't be collusion before the game. Like, there'd be no advantage for me bringing my 3 friends and just agreeing before it ever starts that no matter what, we're going to team up and kill whoever. Yep. You know, it's saying that as if everybody at the table didn't know each other and never knew each other coming in and wouldn't have any reason to, you know, have any history together. You know, that's what makes it really tough. So point systems, I think, are imperfect because they're trying to corral something that you shouldn't be able to corral, which is politics.
Yeah, it's very hard to make EDH a game that works in a competitive sense. That's why
quote-unquote fair.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, I think 1v1 EDH would be very simple to police and make sure it works well. Once again, to the...
But then it's not really EDH, is it?
Yeah,
or it's secret partners. If they add secret partners to it, you
it's
know,
just hard to quantify though. Like who wins and how does that person win? And can someone that doesn't be, that isn't the last person standing win? Because with a point system, that could actually be the case, right? Like you could have enough points potentially by doing other stuff that you're declared the quote unquote winner of a game. I think in a lot of ways it actually limits the kind of deck building too. Because if you're really focused on, like, for instance, the highest way you can get points is by killing another opponent, then that's going to be the focus of all your decks, and you're going to have a very different meta than is has been maybe just established by just playing for fun at your local game store. So I would be very careful if you were in LGS that you don't mix the competitive with the social part of EDH too much. And I know there are people with competitive edges that want to play the game competitively. I think just as a player and as a story, you should approach it in a way that there's a clear separation of the two, and that you're not overly rewarding someone for doing something that may not be healthy for the store or for the players and the mentality that they have towards the game.
Yeah, it's just very easy to game the system when you start putting a bunch of rules and ways on how EDH and the multiplayer aspect works. I would think participation-based is probably the way to go, and it may just be like, if you play in 4 FNMs, you get enough points to get a couple booster packs or something, you know?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
You know, that's the way to go. Or, you know, but then people want the competitive side of it. You don't want, like, you know, well, then what am I playing for? What am I even trying to win? So I don't know what the answer is.
It also comes down to, like, how much money can you spend on your deck to now, like, beat on other people? Like,
the money curve there does actually.
You know, because if somebody only has enough money to create, like, a mediocre deck and they're showing up every Friday and, like, trying to win, but they can't. You know, it's much different when you're opening up the cards there and you have to build your deck versus when you are bringing...
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
absolutely.
But standard works, modern works, legacy
modern,
works.
Yeah.
You know, but those have natural competitive ways that they're meant to be played because I'm playing one on one. We both agree to the same rules coming in. EDH is just so much variance from that because now it's like, well, I'm playing, but if I can convince Jimmy to team up with me, then it's a totally different game. And if I can, if I know Jimmy before I walk into the store, then it's much easier to do that. And so all of a sudden, like, certain people have way more advantage coming in.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a really sticky wicket. I don't know what the...
It's tough too, because I think stuff like legacy tournaments fall into the same category. Sometimes people can outmoney someone else for something, and there's just other weird restrictions when you have an eternal format.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be tricky ground, and I hope there are some success stories at local game stores.
Hopefully somebody figures it out. You know, me personally, I don't tend to want to have any desire to play EDH competitively like that. I'll play draft or sealed competitively, and I play EDH with my friends and, you know, with strangers we meet. But we're not playing for anything. I think once there are stakes, EDH is kind of not a great format.
See, and I know a card shop down in Santa Monica that has been doing EDH League for a while that they, you know, they do it the point system, and then at the end they do points for, they do raffles and, you know, give players certain, you know, credits to the store for a certain amount of points. And it's worked for them for a while. And, you know, I love it. I love playing EDH, so... Yep. You know, being rewarded for playing EDH sounds great to me.
That's right. So also, if you guys, you know, if you are part of a game store that's trying to do something cool and fresh and maybe is the innovative way to do it, let us know, because I want to know. I want to find out, because I'm always interested in this sort of game design stuff and game experience stuff. All right, moving on, we have a question from Mike Murphy at Gonzo Papa. I think that's my favorite Twitter name so far. That's pretty sweet.
Awesome.
And the question is,
what is an effective mana base for a commander deck, and how important are fetch lands in the format?
Well, effective mana base, I would say that most people play too few lands. Mm-hmm. I see a lot or hear about a lot of 33 land decks.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Out of 100?
Yeah. Ugh. Because the old sort of standard operating procedure was 1/3 of your deck should be lands.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's sort of a little bit antiquated, and also it's so bad in Commander to have a game where you don't draw lands. It's worse than other formats because our games are longer. So in
a
standard game, if you're playing standard with your friend or playing competitively, even, at least if you get mana screwed, you're done. You're just done in 5 minutes. Like, you're just done very quickly. In Commander, you can have a game where you're mana screwed and literally be sitting there for 45, 48 minutes where you just can't do anything. And that sucks. It's just, it's not even about winning at that point. It's just like, what am I even doing?
Yeah,
like,
this is not, I'm not actually playing the game right
now. Yeah, so I think it's better to err on the side. And my decks almost always have 37 to 38 lands.
Yep, mm-hmm. I always do 36 to 37.
Yeah, and every once in a while I'll go 36, 35, but that's only if I have like 12 to 15 mana ramp cards.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and even with 37 lands, 38 lands, I'll still have at least 10 mana ramp cards. Oh, of course. So that means that almost half my deck is mana.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then as far as the fetch lands part of the question,
it's interesting. I just started running fetch lands, and so if you're running like in my Rafik deck, fetch lands are fantastic. I'm able to cast Rafik when I want to cast them. I don't have to wait for my mana base to match up, you know, on fifth turn instead of on turn four. So if you're going to cast your commander as soon as possible, like Jimmy, your deck where you get your commander out and then you start putting counters on them and creatures cost that much less.
Oh, Animar, yeah.
Animar, you know, you like you want to get him out ASAP.
Yeah, absolutely.
And fetch lands are fantastic for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in Caridor, I do have my fetch lands in that, but that's because I'm also running Crucible package that just helps me fix up my mana base if, you know, a Blood Moon or something is thrown, because I want that to be as consistent as possible.
Yeah, if you want to talk about fetch lands, I'd say look to what Modern does, because fetch lands specifically let you look for a certain land type, so let's say Mountain or Swamp with Bloodstained Mire. And in that case, usually you can get a Mountain or a Swamp, but you can also get, for instance,
Shocklands
from Return to Zendikar.
Well, we can get dual lands.
Yes, and you can also get dual lands as well. So if you look at Modern, they're always grabbing Shocklands and stuff, and that really does help fix your mana base up. So fetch lands are important. They're not going to be the dominating part of your mana base, but if you are able to search up dual land Shocklands from that, and I think that's the most affordable and...
Shocklands are. Dual lands aren't.
Right, dual lands aren't, but I think Shocklands are the most... going to be the most common option for most players. Yeah.
And there are also other unique mountains and forests especially,
right.
And you know, all of the different basic land types, there are special lands that they've made over the years that have those basic land types, but you know, have some other special ability as well, so you right. can search those up.
Yeah, I mean, fetch lands are good. How important are they for the format though? I feel like, you know, I feel like land is... Like, I'm fine playing Guild Gates. I'm fine playing Refuges. You know, they're just not great lands in general. They wouldn't mm-hmm. be played in Standard.
Or the Vivid lands
or something.
And stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because usually it feels like Commander doesn't come down to that precise of, like, if I don't have my 8th mana on turn 8 available to me, I lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not that kind of format generally. So being a turn slow doesn't tend to matter too much. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you want to optimize, fetch lands are great.
Yeah,
but a lot of times being not optimized is in your favor.
Mm-hmm. I think
because you're less scary.
Yeah, and I think fetch lands are really just important if you're running like five color, because then you want to have the option to get the land that really helps you out the most. You know, to get that dual land.
Yeah, the great thing in like Chromat is like something that fetches a plains or an island literally mm-hmm. fetches me any color I want.
Yeah, exactly. Like yep. a Bloodstained Mire can get you two colors that aren't even close to it. Like you can get Steam Vents because you can get red with it.
So I mean, you can get Badlands, Underworld, Sea, Bayou.
Mm-hmm.
You can get, you know, get any color.
Yeah.
With your red or with your black. So.
Yeah, and you need to get specific if you're running like a five color deck. All right, Mike Murphy's second question is,
where do you get your deck building ideas from?
I'd like to say I get it from a lot of it from Reddit and EDH, /EDH, and /MagicTCG, because cards pop up, ideas pop up all the time. I also get a lot of ideas from just you guys. Playing around you dudes has helped me just like think of combinations I wouldn't have, in interactions I wouldn't have thought of otherwise, introduces me to new cards, helps me build a lot.
Yeah, playing with friends, tappedout.net, my god, like Tapped Out, I've looked at that so many times when I'm building a deck.
That's when you already started. What gets you started?
What gets me started building a deck is, you know, I'll find a general that I'm interested in, and then the first thing that I actually will do will be go to Tapped Out, mm-hmm. see how mm-hmm. other people have built it. Then, you know, if I've played against it though with you guys, obviously that'll play into it. And when I'm walking around my local, you know, card store, just looking in the window and seeing what they got, you know, that's always interesting too. So can spark some ideas.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know how to answer it. I don't.
That was actually how I got into Grand Arbiter. I saw it at my local card shop, and I was like, "Wow,
yeah, holy I think mother. That's how that's where I get my ideas, or how I start is like I don't actually actively. I don't think I've ever just been like I'm going to build a deck. You know what I mean? Like, I think I've always just like, as I'm sort of looking at new cards as the new set comes out, or I'm looking at, you know, going through old cards, building another deck. A lot of times, well, this happens all the time, actually, is like, I'll be building, putting together a deck, like the Stop Hitting Yourself deck I put together recently. And I'm just going through a bunch of cards, you know, and I just have this box of cards that are like cards I want to use somewhere someday. And so at the end of, like, I've got a list. I've got all the stuff I want to put in this deck. And then I pull out that box and I just go through it and see if there's anything in there that I want to put in the Stop Hitting Yourself deck. And as I'm doing that, I'll be like, come across this card. And then there'll be some card like Arcbond from Fate Reforged.
Oh, gosh, Arcbond.
You know, or something like that. And I'll be like, oh, that card just came out. This card I've always wanted to use. Okay, put those two together. And then I start, you know, all the possibilities start swirling, and then I start
going. It's a possibility storm.
Then I chase the rabbit hole from there. So I think that it's really just about letting that spark organically come.
Josh found this Planeswalker spark, and the deck builder within him launched into action.
That's why whenever that happens, I end up building the deck in like a week and ordering all the cards. Because
it's like a fever dream, right?
Yeah, it's just like this flame, and it's this fire, and it's going to burn out really fast, and I need to take advantage of it otherwise. Yeah.
Well, you got to burn out the fire or your wallet, one or the other.
Or both, usually both.
Definitely. All right, our next question comes from Ken Schlosser, and this might take the title for my new favorite Twitter
name. This is an awesome Twitter name.
It's @CephalidSushi.
Sweet. Yeah. Does it have a tide counter on it? The sushi comes with a tide counter.
Yeah, and it's delicious. Oh, man, it's making me hungry. All right, the question.
Should I invest in making one deck that I'm really happy with, or diversify and make many decks that maybe aren't as complete?
Great. How much do you want to spend? Because if you make a few decks that you aren't that happy with, guess what? You're going to be spending your next paycheck to make yourself happier with the decks.
Right. That's a really good point.
So, you know, like, how much do you really want to spend? Yeah.
Honestly, I like seeing it as like, don't, if you want to play Commander, you want to build some decks. Like, obviously, if you ask this question, I think there's someone in you is also going like, I want to build more decks so I can have more commanders, but I don't know how I should spend. I'd say start off with one deck, you know, or start off with a pre-con and then go from there. And once you finish your first deck and get it kind of close, then I think you should start thinking about your second and third decks, because I feel like the best decks, instead of making a bunch at once, I feel like the way that you're going to make the best decks is if you make a deck in one color pie specifically, you're going to want to make a deck in another branch of it. And I think that will allow you to diversify your commander portfolio a lot better, because you're used to playing one deck and maybe you want to try something else out. I think that's going to help you out.
But there's this moment, I think, that comes for everybody, especially when you build that first deck, where you're faced with the question. And the question is, I have a limited amount of money to invest in this hobby, and I can invest that money either continuing to perfect what I've got, or I can let that sit and I can start something new. And that question really
launch off
is hard to answer without knowing what your personality is. But both are okay. You know, it's just, what do you want? Do you want one very powerful deck, or do you want a couple sort of slightly less powerful decks?
Right.
You know, and that's what's going to happen at first. And then you can have two decks, and then that question comes again. And the question is, do I want two powerful decks, or do I want one of these decks to become more powerful, or do I want a third?
And we can tell from the way that this question's phrased, this person's a spike. I mean, they want one powerful deck.
Yeah. And I think there are advantages to having a second deck.
And absolutely.
The advantages are, they don't know what deck you're playing in. The advantage also is, hey, listen, one deck's really oppressively powerful and the other one's not.
Yeah.
And you can sort of negotiate with your playgroup, or not negotiate, but it's an olive branch, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I beat you twice with this deck. Okay, I'll pull up my not so powerful deck. We'll have fun.
Right. And no one might hold a grudge against you for
exactly.
that.
Exactly. It's like the pressure meter. Mm-hmm. You know, and you let some air out, so the pressure goes back down. And then you play your oppressive deck, and the pressure meter is getting back there. It's getting into the red.
I'm going to recommend go for the deck you want, make the powerful deck, and then with $20 extra, make a black and green Gliss of the Traitor infect deck with non-foils, just basic instants and, you know, and commons.
You're a monster, Craig.
You are a monster.
You don't want anybody to like this guy.
You'll have two unbelievably powerful decks and that no you friends. Can just beat face every time.
It's okay. Gliss is my friend now. She's my best friend.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I actually believe having a deck that's not as powerful and playing that sometimes and giving that to your playgroup actually will make your win percentage go up.
That's right.
I could see that.
Yeah, I could see that too.
But I say, I forget that. Yeah. No, never.
We've got too much experience playing with you, Craig, to know that you would ever mean any different. Our next question comes from Jeff
Hlutke.
Hlutke or Hluk? I could see it being pronounced a number of ways.
It's a tough one. I don't know. But his Twitter name is easier.
Yeah, at Falcon Jeff. And
Millennium Falcon?
Millennium Falcon.
I'm just going to assume.
Yeah. Or Falcon Punch, like Captain Falcon.
Millennium Falcon's cooler.
Yeah, it is cooler and much faster. All right, his question is,
how do you approach playing with different power level playgroups? My meta at home is very different than my meta at school.
Different decks is one good different way decks to do is, it. Yeah, and another way is just to make those sort of like those game time decisions, as it were. It's just like, oh, this meta is a lot weaker. I'm just not going to play this card.
Yeah,
I have it in my hand, and I'll just pretend I mulliganed.
Or just if you draw it in your opening hand, you can mulligan in a way that's going to be more conducive to a just less aggressive, you know, meta or whatever it is in that case.
Yeah, always remember that you control if you're OP or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. You can just choose not to play cards.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you've done that. You can put a handicap.
I can't
on
do it. I can't bring myself to not play it.
We were playing this game with the guys from the Masters of Modern podcast. We played them a lot, and I was playing my Nekusar deck, and I had all the stuff out that everyone was drawing a ton of cards, and Kessler's sitting to the right of me, and he's just having a ball. He has Reliquary Tower out.
Oh yeah.
He has Consecrated Sphinx out. I'm making him draw like everybody draw like a ton of cards. Plus I have Teferi's Puzzle Box out. So what that means is he literally has 50 cards in his hand. And every turn, he exchanges that for the 50 cards in his deck. So he's seeing his entire deck every other turn, whichever cards he wants. He's just having the time of his life. I'm sitting there, I'm staring at all the cards that will kill him for having all those cards in his hand. And I'm just like, no. He's having too much fun. I'm just gonna let him
be.
Do this thing. Yeah,
because he does love this game so much. Yeah,
and it's
too.
Like, hey, are they your friends? Yeah. Because if they're your friends, then them having fun should be like that should make you happy. And if that does, then there are going to be times when you're like, you know what? They're having a fun. It doesn't matter if I win this game or not. It's, you know, my self-worth is not tied up in whether I win this game of EDH or Commander. And it just feels so much better to just look over there and the guy's just having fun. He's playing all this stuff. And he's doing crazy stuff. And you're just like, you just kill everybody, man. You do it.
And the thing is, like, that's what brought me into the game originally was that feeling, that sort of joy of being able to do stuff and doing fun stuff and doing the stuff that you've spent money and time investing in this deck to do that. So, I mean, I think I love the idea of playing with a more relaxed meta because I think that just in general can make you a better, I don't know, a human being in general because you get to, you know, have joy at other people having joy, which is
exactly.
a wonderful thing.
I've said this many times, like when someone's about to go off and the other people want to concede and I'm like, don't concede. Let him do the thing,
man. Especially
if
he's never done it before.
Yeah.
You know?
Just he came up with an idea. He looked cards up on the internet. He went on Tapped Out and looked at everybody else who built the same deck and he built it better and he's about to finally put this four-card combination that he had in Magical Christmas Land in his head into play, and you're going to concede on him? Come on, what kind of friend are you, man? Let him do the thing.
Yeah, because if you were in his case, you would want other people to let you do the thing as well.
Yeah, it's like people want to like take it away from you. They want to concede so that you don't beat them, so you don't do the thing, so you don't have that pleasure. Why?
Yeah, why?
What does it cost you to let them have that?
Well, it costs you losing for a little bit longer than had you.
Just,
yeah, it's true. It is very
silly.
I just
don't get that. Just get outside of yourself for a few minutes.
Like, I think the more you've played, it just games in general, and you have those moments yourself, and you understand what it's like to be on both ends of the spectrum. I think you will eventually sort of grow into that in general. I feel like the more you play games and the more, especially stuff that's politics-based, because you understand what it means to hold a grudge over a long time. You understand what it means to like sabotage something and... You'll understand at the right moments when to let other people just have their candy.
Let them have their candy.
Yeah, exactly. Don't steal the candy from the baby. Come on, guys. All right. Next up, we have a question from Andreu Fernandez. I almost said with a French accent at first, and that was not correct. At a Fairies.
What special rules would you recommend to set up in a group to avoid games becoming too long or one-sided?
I don't like special rules.
I think it's all dependent. I'm okay with a special rule as long as it really makes sense and there's a good justification for it. For instance, a 7-player game, you have a 2-minute time limit. That's a special rule that I can live with.
Yeah. Even when we played 7 players, though, we didn't say 2 minutes. We just said, listen, guys, everyone's going to have to play fast, okay?
Or secret partners can also speed up games a lot.
That's true. I don't know if that's a special rule.
It is. It's
we keep threatening.
Rules
we're
going to
definitely do a special partners like episode.
Yeah, secret partners for sure.
Here's the thing I think of as special rules, though. It's just like sort of fly by night, shoot from the hip type rules that you're making up. Like, listen, you're not a game designer. Mm-hmm. Your rule's not going to be balanced. Like, I just in general don't like. It feels like in the old like StarCraft days when people used to like. Play like, I don't know if you guys played StarCraft, but there was always these people and they would play like no rush for 15 minutes only on this map, blah blah blah, like it's just not the game. Like, that's just training wheels. Like, knock it off. And in the end, that's going to hurt you more than it's going to help you, because you're going to learn to play in a certain way that's not how the rest of the world plays. And you want to be able to go to GPs and play with people to local gaming stores or sit down with Jimmy and I someday, you know, if you run into us and play games with us. And if you're not playing by the same rules, we can't do it.
But if somebody is dirtling like for 20 minutes while everybody else is taking their like, you know, 5-minute turns, it can
That's
be.
That's not a rule, though. Right. That's a like, hey, dude.
Yeah.
It's not any fun.
Right.
Like, will you please just speed it up?
Right.
That's not a rule.
And I think, but like, is there anything that you can say when something like that's going on? Or like, what can you do when
it's about having like that conversation we talked about in the prior episode? And it's just something you have to address with
people.
Have that open communication.
You need to do it at the right point in time. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. You don't do it in the middle of the game or right after they've lost or whatever. You just, you know this is happening with the same person over and over. Yeah. You just go like, hey, listen, we want to play a few games tonight. Let's just make sure everybody moves fast.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then when he's taking a while, you're like, dude, we need to move fast, remember? And then they'll usually do it.
And that's the special rule, is that we can ask other players reasonably. It's not a reasonably. Rule. Yeah. What's the quote unquote in the air
it's an
tonight?
Agreement.
Yeah, it's an agreement. Yeah. It's a player's agreement. And I'd say the other thing is, like, there are some groups I know that, like, hey, I have 4 friends. We've all talked about getting into Magic, but we've never done it before. We're all going to get in, and we're all going to just limit ourselves to not, you know, no one can purchase more than, like, this amount of money just to see what we can do. And then, you know, it could become a competition in itself. Who gets the most value for their amount of money that they're allowed to spend, and then see what you can bring to the table? That could be
a special
rule.
Ooh, I like that.
And you're like, buy Goyfs. Buy as many
you buy one
Goyf
and just a bunch of basic lands, and you're like, all right, spent my budget, guys. Hope I draw my Goyf.
Goyfs with a bunch of basic lands sucks.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
That's so worse. Goyfs
in general, an idiot.
Will somebody please cast something?
Yeah, I think if the special rules gives a playing field that lets everyone, you know, do something to the best of their abilities, and it's like something that's actually competitive and kind of
that's almost like a limited format.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, that, okay. I don't hate all rules because that rule sounds cool. I really want to do that, actually.
I'll put the game designer hat on and quickly take it off because I am not a game designer.
It's just constraints, right? That's a different, I don't know. It feels like a different thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, but I would be careful with special rules because I think it's a slippery slope.
It can be too much where it's too much training wheels. And what happens is you get used to that and it hurts you when you go outside of that little box, that, you know, that little tunnel where you play.
Yeah.
You know, you want to be on the same page as what, you know, most people are playing so that you can interact with them.
Yep, definitely. All right. The next question is from X_SackX, which is, I guess, the Sack, hopefully the Sack
outlet. With some X's.
With some X's, yeah. And that's the same as the Twitter name. And the question is,
how do you deal with a playgroup that went from casual to spike while you are still playing Commander just for fun?
Womp womp.
This happens. It totally happens. It's tough. I mean, because one player who's a little competitive will push your entire playgroup towards more competitive.
That's just what happens with any kind of game. Like, even if you're like all just playing Super Smash Brothers and one guy decides to take it a little more seriously, everyone else is going to get raised up by that level.
Or they're just going to get left behind and they won't have as much fun anymore. That's just, I mean, I hate to say it. It feels like it's sort of the nature of games. It happens.
It's human nature, too.
It stinks, but it's either like, hey, man, become a spike or find another play group.
Yeah. I feel like that's the answer we're going to be giving is you may just have to reach out and see if there are other people that are playing at your level or if you can find an acceptable way. And like we said, you don't need to be a spike and spend the most money on cards to be able to win at this game. Like, there are other ways to be very invested in Commander and just you could be an amazing politician and win games based on that, and that would be a whole, you know, separate pleasure.
I mean, I would have way more respect for, and I think that's like a worthy goal is to be like, yeah, I can't spend as much money as this guy, but I can still win because I can do it with politics or I can do it with crappier cards or whatever, you know. But spike doesn't always mean spending more money. It might mean a guy who's just willing to spend more time thinking about his decks and tuning his decks than you are. And it's like, in that case, you know, if you're not willing to do what that guy's doing or you're that guy and nobody else is willing to keep up with you, then you need to find more like-minded individuals, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Moving on, Christopher S. Bond asks via email.
If you had a chance to play Commander with any three other people, alive or dead, who would they be? Bonus question, what Commander do you think each person would play?
Interesting question. I'm assuming that if you revive them from the dead, they would be able to play Commander.
Would it be them at the prime of their life, or, you know, would it be them?
I think you can choose when, right? Okay. You won't get them right before they've died.
Okay.
Don't go for me
first. I would...
Well, go ahead.
I'm going to just say this. I don't even know that much about the person, but I feel like someone like Winston Churchill would be very interesting to play a political game of EDH with.
It feels like he'd be really good at it.
Yeah, maybe he'd be, I don't know,
you
Edric,
could just do
by
like
Master of Tress.
Sun Tzu,
yeah.
Winston Churchill and maybe like Napoleon.
Napoleon.
If you just wanted to get destroyed.
In different ways, mind you. I'd love to see a Gandhi deck or like a Jesus deck that still manages to win without actually like inflicting bodily harm. Like he just plays like turn to frog a bunch instead.
He mills you out.
Yeah.
Oh,
and you end up being on his side at the end.
Una,
as well.
Queen of the Fae. So Jesus would be Una?
I guess so. I mean, we're trying to figure out what commander matches up with them. It could be really anything. It'd be interesting. I think you would want to go and find people that you respected for either like military prowess or like inventors. Like,
I mean, the way we play Commander is like we're sitting around and chatting a lot of the time. I might not even care how they play.
I want to play against right? John Stewart, man. Like someone interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. It might be like, I don't know, like a great philosopher.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, just
it'd be just so cool
like
just
Einstein
to see
or,
what they would
know,
play as well.
Yeah.
Right? How they build the deck. And how it's still effective in certain ways, or like how they
who would Einstein play?
He'd play blue.
Blue,
is
yeah.
it?
Maybe
he'd play something that would involve math. What involves a lot of math? He'd play an artifact deck. Like, is there an
I feel like he would
want to
take.
Deck?
I feel like
storm.
He would want to take.
Storm.
Oh, storm. Yeah, or he would be taking.
Storm's
extra
like the hardest.
Okay,
thing
he'd
to
be
play
taking
correctly.
Extra turns all too right. for sure. He'd be messing with time and space itself.
Yeah. All right, storm then.
Yeah, there you go. I feel like you could just choose great military leaders or like Leonardo da Vinci.
I thought you were going to say DiCaprio, and I was going to be like, what?
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio, just because I want to meet Leo. Come on. Yeah, it'd
be Da Vinci
be really
would
cool.
just be doing like alters to all the cards.
Yeah, and he'd be playing ornithopters and stuff. Like, yeah, he would definitely be. He would focus heavily on Therese Nielsen art because I feel like that's very much in the world of his sort of creatorship and the craziness.
What do you think like Caligula would be?
Caligula?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Be a mono red.
Mono red? Yeah. I was going to say Genghis Khan would be mono red, but I feel like he would just be the Mardu horde.
Genghis Khan would definitely flip the table on you if he lost. I know.
Oh,
that.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. I feel like Genghis Khan
and
would
he'd be
like
playing with
Gavi
Mongolian cards. What if
he'd
you didn't know what the card
red.
Did?
Yeah.
Rakdos.
Yeah. Rakdos.
Okay.
Yeah. All aggression, no regret.
He has to play Mardu Heartpiercer because that's the most Genghis Khan card ever printed. Like, and a bunch of P3K horsemanship cards too, of course.
Yes.
Great question though. I really like that. But yeah, like Josh said, I'd like to just talk to them for a while and just put the cards aside. Maybe
it'd be cool if the game itself. Like, I think that I would go in that direction. People who I don't care about the game so much, I just get to sit at the table with them.
Yeah. All right. Our next question comes from Richard Blakely at Kirito552, which I believe is a shout out to the anime Sword Art Online. And Richard asks,
what is the best Cloak and Dagger commander?
I'm going to say Edric, Spymaster
of Trest.
Yeah.
He is the Spymaster, right?
Without question.
There you go.
So many.
That was the quickest answered question yet.
So many rogues in that. You'll be able to equip anything you want.
Yeah. Or there's also, is it Lazav, Dimir Mastermind? Or
yeah. He's not as cloak and dagger as Edric.
True. But doesn't he have a cloak and dagger in his art? I don't know. Maybe.
Probably does, but he's not as cloak and dagger as Edric.
That's true. Edric is definitely. But
and especially with Edric, you build it with unblockable creatures, and then you just draw a ton of cards, and that makes it untargetable.
He's the Spymaster.
Yeah.
You can't get more cloak and dagger. All right, next question.
Have fun.
Unless
you're
you can make Whisper Silk Cloak a commander.
By the way, that deck way better one-on-one or one-on-two than in big multiplayer.
Definitely. All right, Richard's next question.
Are there any good black board wipe spells?
There's lots. Ready? Crux of Fate.
Ah.
Damnation.
I was going to say Damnation. We're going to go with Decree of Pain.
Toxic Deluge.
Good one. Black Sun Zenith.
Oh, man. You keep taking mine.
You got in the bad seat because you're in the third seat.
I know.
Anyway, that's a lot.
There are a bunch. Damnation is the most expensive out of all of them, but a lot of them are very cheap. Toxic Deluge, I think, is one of my favorites.
Toxic Deluge is one of the
best. What's the one destroy
board
everybody else's creatures?
In Garruk's Wake. I don't know. I think we gave him enough.
Yeah, there's a bunch of black board wipes out there. You could also just look up this on Google, and usually there's some forum thread on MTG Salvation or whatever that has this question answered in detail,
but
which is
my
always nice.
My favorites, Toxic Deluge.
Yeah, Toxic Deluge is
unbelievable. And any others that you would think like a staple, like a have to have?
I think In Garruk's Wake is hilarious if you can get it cast just because it's destroy all other creatures and like
what's the one Decree of
Decree of Annihilation.
Decree of Pain.
And there's Decree of Pain. Decree of Annihilation, I think, gets rid of everyone's stuff but yours.
Which one draws you all the cards
that's
for the
Decree
ones?
Of Pain, I think.
Oh, Decree of Annihilation is actually
why are we still
red.
Talking about
yeah,
this?
Yeah, which is red.
Yeah, it's true.
Guys, we've answered his question like thoroughly.
Yeah, it's true.
All right, next question.
Are there any good cards that synergize with Nekusar the Mindraiser?
Okay, I'm going to answer this one really quick. Episode 13, there's a ton. Just go listen to it.
There's a ton. And they're actually in all five colors, as you would have it.
Well, most of the ones that synergize with him are in the right colors.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so that is all the questions we're going to answer for now. So hopefully you heard your name. Again, email us your address at commandcast@rocketjump.com, and we will send you out your prizes. So
Yep. Let us know what question you asked as well. So for
or
our
questions.
Record. Or questions, correct.
All right, time for the end step.
End step time, cleanup phase. We actually didn't do this last week, so we got to do it this week. End step is a phase in Magic, but it's also a part of this podcast where we talk about stuff that may not be related to the world of Magic, to the gathering, but it is something that we're thinking about and we're interested in. Josh?
Mine is going to be a podcast called Hardcore History, because we talked about Genghis Khan just a second ago and made me think of it. It's called Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Go check it out.
Cool.
I've been looking at 3D printers, so yeah, I've been looking at the Ultimaker 2. Anybody have any thoughts, please leave a comment.
All right, and the cool thing I found this week was the Rolli keyboard. It's R-O-L-I. It's this crazy pressure-sensitive keyboard that doesn't look like any keyboard you've ever seen, but it creates makes instant Blade Runner soundtrack music. So if you guys haven't checked that out, there are some really interesting videos on that as well.
Very cool.
And also, I guess this is 2 weeks out, but the shirt is both white and gold and purple and black. So
it's amazing.
If you guys remember this,
no one
two
will
weeks
talk
later,
about that.
Yeah,
weeks
exactly.
Later. Yeah.
I'm interested to see the people that are still finding out about it or don't know about it by the 2 week period. So let us know as well if you just found out about this crazy wild thing.
Dress,
bro.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
I'll see you next time.
Peace.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.